Consumer Affairs, and welcome. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2681. Who's going to start here? Please introduce yourself and welcome.
Senator Nelson and Senators, for the record, my name is Mary Bryant, and I'm here representing Senator Neil Bryant, District 27. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2681. We had an unfortunate free fuel utility problem in Central Oregon. It's quite unique in the fact that it's within a city. It is a company that both controls, a private company that both controls the wastewater and the household water for quite a large area in Southern Bend. Last November, that area was annexed into the city. And a while back, when the PUC took over regulation of water, the owner of this utility company started actually publicly declared that he no longer could charge what he wanted for water, so he was going to dump all of his exorbitant charges into the sewer customers. So he started increasing the sewer rates at such an astronomical rate that we began hearing from our Neil's constituents about the problems this was causing, especially for people on fixed incomes. So we had heard about this, and also Representative Knope, and Representative Knope dropped this legislation on the House side, and it is to has a very, very narrow focus. It has to do with utilities that are within a city boundary and are privately owned, and both provide for sewage and water. And if there is a problem, then they would become under the jurisdiction of the Public Utilities Commission. And it is narrow enough that this is the only situation in the state that we're able to find that falls under this definition. So we're hoping that you will also like the House be clear to passing this legislation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm back.
Joan Smith. Happy to see you.
From the PUC, we share Senator Bryant's concern over this particular company, and as time went on, we tried to work out a solution that would exclude every company but this company and use something less vague than in a city. However, it didn't work out, and we're very comfortable with the bill as it stands, with a couple of housekeeping amendments, including an emergency clause, because they, I think July 1st is when you start having to have a contract with them. And I have really nothing to add.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Gallagher. I represent Sun River. And we are, have no problem with the housekeeping amendments for the PUC, and I'd ask Mary to comment on the emergency clause because of the city, but we're very comfortable that the bill includes the people who need to be included and excludes the people who don't need to be.
Because of the annex, Mary Bryant, because of the annexation happening last November, they have got to, by July 1st of this year, have a contract signed with this utility. So they're hoping that upon passage, it could become effective. It would help them in their contract negotiations.
So we don't have any?
At this time, no.
Do we have an amendment? We do not have an amendment.
No, we don't at this time. It's just brought to our attention.
You do want
yes.
An amendment?
Chair, members of the committee, Joan Smith again. We did have one written up, and with the permission of the chair of the House Committee, and we thought it had gone to Legislative Council, but it didn't reappear, so we do have a copy of it here today.
Oh, do you have a copy? Yes,
with the emergency power.
Thank you. Is it an LC form?
Yeah.
Sorry. That didn't even get that far.
Okay. Well, I think the president would give us directly to that kind of thing in healthy form.
Questions?
Yes.
Mario, John, either one. I'm curious, why, if this was annexed into the city, why doesn't the city then regulate?
John, would you like to?
The chair, members of the, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, because it's an investor-owned company, the city just annexed the land, but they didn't take over the running of the administration.
Don't you have the authority to regulate?
No.
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, I don't believe they can regulate the rates.
Okay.
Senator Nelson,
yes.
Senator Beyer, just like an electric utility that's privately owned, it's within city limits like Portland General, because this is a water company.
Further questions? Well, I think we'll have to have just a minute, so we can't move the bill. Does anybody have any problems with the bill as written? Close public hearing. We'll get the healthy draft emergency clause and bring it back in the next.
Thank you.
Couple days. Okay. So what's the best thing going on? We're going to. Okay. We open up a public hearing on House Bill 2579. And I guess, Joan, you should have stayed up here. How about Joan, Shelley, and Jenny? Well, hello. This is old homage. We just did this room. Welcome, and who wants to start this out?
Yeah.
Okay. Start whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joan Smith, and I'm a member of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2579, the so-called Yellow Pages Bill. I have testimony in front of you, which is in a question-answer mode, and it's done that way because of the questions that arose during the House hearings and throughout discussion of putting this bill together. The first issue that the Commission wishes to raise with you is the issue of the bill's premise. We don't see Yellow Pages as a subsidy, but as both tangible and intangible assets that belong to customers. And so for many decades, Yellow Page revenues have been roughly equally shared, net revenues, between customers and shareholders. So customers don't get the whole 100%, but they get roughly 50%. Should the bill pass, that means that U.S. West local rates, both business and residential lines, would be $3.70 more expensive. And GTE local rates would be $2.70 more expensive. Does House Bill 2579 reverse longstanding court-tested regulatory treatment? Yes, it does. No court, either before or after the Act, Telecommunications Act of 1996, has held that imputing, which is the regulatory term for sharing those revenues, is illegal. I think one of the biggest issues on page 2 that arose during the conversation is Will implementing Oregon's Universal Service Fund eliminate the basis for sharing? And we say no, because Universal Service Fund is related to affordability of telecommunications service. And yellow pages are simply not related to the facility costs and the operating costs of providing local exchange service. The Commission's legal basis for sharing yellow pages revenues is its direct relationship, that is, the yellow pages direct relationship to the local exchange business. It isn't about making rates more affordable. And here's the fundamental disagreement with the proponents of the bill. Will continuing to share Yellow Pages revenues with customers constitute a subsidy? We say no. In fact, directing all Yellow Page revenues to shareholders is a subsidy of non-regulated business by regulated operations. U.S. West non-regulated affiliate for no fee is able to take advantage then of the regulated company's market power in the local exchange market. And as a policy matter on another bill, Senate Bill 1149A in Gross, Section 6, Sub 3, and Subsection C, which was passed, provides that there should be no cross-subsidy between competitive operations and regulated operations, including the use of electric company and other resources. So the Senate's already made a statement on, in that regard on the electric side. We think a good public policy is to say the same thing on the telecommunications side. Will the onset of competition in local telecommunications market and in telephone directories make the sharing of directory revenues inappropriate? We don't believe so in the short term. Telecommunications competition at the residential level is virtually non-existent. There are some other points to be made in my testimony, but going forward, I believe that we can work out a transition for yellow pages. The committee wishes us to do so. So that yellow pages benefits, the property that belongs to ratepayers, will go to the ratepayers in the short term, and that perhaps another way of making these revenues competitively neutral in a transition era, say the next 2 to 4 years, might be the time for a solution to the yellow pages. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Michelle.
Chairman Nelson, committee members, I'm Shelley Jensen, regulatory and legislative manager for GCE. This bill would, I have prepared testimony, but I'm really just going to kind of summarize it in the interest of time. This bill would prohibit the Public Utilities Commission from using revenues derived from yellow pages to subsidize local rates. Only directory companies that are affiliated with local, incumbent local telephone companies are required to use revenues from their business to provide a subsidy for local telephone rates. Non-affiliated yellow pages or other types of directory providers such as internet providers are not required to offer that subsidy. It's important to note too that yellow pages revenues are not generated by residential customers. They're instead another way of business customers subsidizing local rates. But yellow pages revenues is from business advertising, so that the money is derived from business ratepayers, not local residential ratepayers. Yellow Pages business is a fully competitive industry. There are other Yellow Pages providers in Oregon. There are internet providers which provide competition to Yellow Pages. And in addition, from the perspective of a business person looking to advertise their business, they're also competitors of local newspapers, direct mailers, those kinds of things. GCE Directories and GCE Northwest are two separate companies. They're both owned by GCE, but we do not have common employees, common facilities, nothing like that. 63% of the Yellow Pages advertising revenues generated are used, are retained by the local exchange company and used to keep local rates low. And we believe that in a time when the policy has been articulated that competition is to be encouraged in the local exchange service, that it's the time to get these subsidies out of local rates. In fact, in Nevada, Sprint is currently being sued for antitrust violations by a competitive carrier who wants to get in to that business, but does not have the Yellow Pages affiliate, and basically said, we don't have the subsidy to draw on. Sprint is using the subsidy to keep local rates below cost. We can't match that cost, and therefore they're acting in an anti-competitive manner by using a non-local telephone company revenues to keep rates below cost, to keep competitors out of the business. And we would like your support on Senate Bill at House Bill 2579.
Yes. Senator Byer.
Shaw, you made the point that GC Directories and GC Northwest are separate companies.
Mm-hmm.
Does GC Northwest sell listings to Data Bank to any other companies?
Yes. They sell it to other Yellow Pages providers.
And when you sell your listing, you sell it roughly the same rate?
Yes.
To sell it to the sister company with the same rate you sell it to others?
What we have an arrangement with our sister company that, if anything, it's more than what we would sell it to others. The telephone company pays certain costs of, for example, distributing the phone books, and they retain its larger 63% of the revenues. So when that's netted out, that they do pay, probably, if you look at it on a per-subscriber basis, more than another competitor would pay. But yes, they do pay. And the money that's paid for the white pages type listings does remain with the local telephone company. That is a regulated, that does belong to the ratepayer. And that money, regardless of what happens with this bill, will stay with the regulated company. It's just the advertising portion of the
bill. If you sell your list to a direct mail company, for example,
mm-hmm.
The revenue that you get from that, does that go into your rate base?
Yes.
How many Yellow Pages page advertisers are there?
In Oregon, there are, I believe, 6, not necessarily in every community, because some of them, you know, only advertise in their local areas, but there are, throughout the state, a total of 6 providers.
And then you mentioned the Internet. Are the Internet, is the Internet doing Yellow Page type advertising? Or
it's very similar in the sense of, for example, some of the search engines, if you're looking for a particular type of business, you can type that business in and search for, you know, where across the country or wherever that you could then purchase from that company in the same way that you could call up your local company after finding them in the Yellow Pages.
And then you talked about this Nevada case. Mm-hmm. In fact, that is another local telephone company is coming in saying that the Yellow Pages is actually substituted and is detrimental to their ability to compete.
Right.
Right. Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jenny Lang, representing U.S. West, and I'm here at the invitation of the chairman. Primarily, I just wanted to fill in some details about the relationship between U.S. West and its publishing company, JEX. JEX is a separate, unregulated company owned by the shareholders of U.S. West, which sells advertising and is the official publisher of over 100 different over 100 different telephone companies. U.S. West provides its customers with a white pages directory and sells its telephone listings to over 50 different publishers, including JEX. The revenue U.S. West generates from selling telephone listings is appropriately included in our regulated revenues. We believe that it is not appropriate to continue to impute the revenues from the advertising and publishing business, which is a separate unregulated company, just as the revenues from others of our separate companies, for example, the communication services, which provides customer premises equipment to large business customers, wire services, U.S. West Long Distance, are other similar kinds of companies whose revenues are not imputed. Finally, we believe that House Bill 2579 implements the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996, which intended to eliminate implicit subsidies such as Yellow Pages imputation from local rates. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Are there any other implicit subsidies that are significant in this area? Hey, John, what the PUC use when they figure out the implicit subsidies besides Yellow Pages?
Mr. Chairman, that's kind of a tricky question.
Uh-oh.
First of all, we insist that this is not a subsidy. But let's say it is a subsidy. Even if it is a subsidy under the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the Act says that you don't have to get rid of the subsidies, you just have to make them explicit, which would mean in this case is you have a separate line that says $3 for U.S. West and $2 for GTE belongs to revenue coming that is shared from the Yellow Pages. But other subsidies that are mixed up in that great ball of yarn that we call local rates include business subsidizing residential, urban subsidizing rural, certain federal subsidies like the subscriber line charge, or something that's called the Pixie. I can never remember what it was. Common carrier line charge. All of this stuff is mixed up in the rates both at the local and federal levels, and that's what we're in the business of trying to unravel and have been these last 3 years. Where you will see most of them is in the high-cost fund for universal service, both at the state level and at the federal level. Where you will see others of them is simply in separate line charges that you see on your bill, and that's why there's such a list of them cropping up.
So, did you have a question?
I did. Jenny, the DEX is a wholly owned subsidiary of U.S. West.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, yes.
So it is technically a separate corporation. And does U.S. West sell the directory information, the data bank, to DEX on the same terms as it sells it to other?
Senator Nelson, Senator Beyer, yes.
So it's the same rate? Similar to that?
I should probably check. We may have the same kind of arrangement as GTE does. I'm not sure that we sell listings at exactly the same price to ourselves as we do to others, but it would be on a very similar basis. And if that's important, I'd be happy to check that for you, Senator.
Joan, are the agreements with U.S. West or GTE, do they require that they do the Yellow Page and White Page directory business?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, do they require...
We require that they publish directories in the directory assistance business.
Are the companies required to provide Yellow Pages? Is that the question?
Sure.
No. However,
if they were to get out of the business and choose to sell it, say, to in the current merger to TCI, and continue to sell the information to them, how would that affect? Would that business, the Yellow Page business, then if they sold it off, would that be completely off the books for imputing rates?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, that's an excellent question because I can give a good example of how that would work. We would contend that if a company put its Yellow Pages business up for sale, let's say for auction, that part of that money should go to ratepayers because of its link to the local exchange service, and part should go to shareholders. The bill instead says it should all go to the shareholders.
Well, let's just assume it went the way of many corporate mergers now, and there really wasn't a arm's reach sale, but merely an exchange of stock.
Okay.
It's pretty common.
Yeah, every day. You never know.
Well, couldn't we solve this whole problem? We just passed out 142, then you don't have to worry about anything.
One solution, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, would be to have the company buy out the interest of the customers as well.
Now, what's the question?
I know. I was just trying to get that in there.
But would that change anything?
No.
So how would you compute that? You would then take, I'm assuming that, if, for example, I'm sorry I'm picking on U.S. West, but it's happens to be there. If they were to do a cross trade and all of a sudden they weren't doing it, but another company they happened to own business in was doing that, would the PUC then try to impute earnings off of their stock holdings?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, no, the imputation would be off of a portion of their net revenues from that particular business.
From which business?
The Yellow Page business.
But if it wasn't their business?
Anybody's business.
Would you use that same thing if they sold it to a mailing company?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, if they sold it to a mailing company, we would insist that as part of the sale that some of the proceeds go to the customer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if the witnesses other than Commissioner Smith had an opportunity to see the opinion rendered by the Department of Justice about this particular proposal?
No.
No, it's conveniently released today. So you haven't had a chance to read it? I guess I just would inquire, Commissioner Smith, do you know when this opinion was requested?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I do not know exactly. In fact, I just got it this morning as well. I believe staff has been working on it. The concern here, as has been mentioned in the past, is that the relationship of Yellow Pages to the A4, the infamous A4, we feel is still a part of a contractual relationship. In fact, in the order that was issued in 1991, it was agreed between the company and the commission and the parties that the issue of Yellow Pages would not come up again either in court or before the legislature before 2001. So I felt it was important that I included in the testimony, which was written this morning as well.
It's, Mr. Chairman, I guess, I suppose it's not shocking, but I mean, this matter has been under discussion since, I guess, well, I'm sure preceding its first hearing date over a month ago in the House. There were three hearings. Do you know if this question about constitutionality and the, whether or not that was brought up in the House discussion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I don't think so. However, Commissioner Hamilton gave the first presentation on Yellow Pages, and I gave the second one, so if it was discussed in the first meeting, I don't know that. But no, I don't think so. I think this committee gets treated to our constitutionality arguments.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've just observed in the closing, Mr. Schuman does say, in our view, or in view of our conclusion, that House Bill 2579 probably would violate the contracts clause, and because the Senate may consider it, they're going to give us its opinion without rendering some decision on the federal constitution. For Mr. Schuman, who suggested it probably would violate his borders on lawful and even for a lawyer. So I don't think I would spend a whole lot of time worrying about this particular opinion.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess both Ginny and Joan, I appreciate your comment on this, dealing with our previous bill of SB 142. Let's just hypothesize that SB 142 has left this committee, which I know is quite a hypothesis, were to become law, which also set a limit price on residential service. How might the enactment of this legislation be viewed by U.S. West? And Joan, if you have any comment about how that might affect residential service in light of the limit cap of it established by 142. Neither one wants to go first.
Funny. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I'm only speaking for myself in this case, and trying to imagine how that might go. But let's say 142A in gross passed as it is. Part of what's in Section 6 would still allow the rate case, the infamous rate case, UT 125, to go forward to the courts, and the issue around yellow pages would be settled in the both the revenue requirement and the rate design under that jurisdiction. Whatever came out of that would then become a part of the price gap limits.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, we believe that, and it has been our belief all along, that one of the things that Senate Bill 142, and let me back up a minute, we introduced a bill that specifically dealt with universal service funding, and it was our belief that that was a way over time, as the Commissioner mentioned actually in her testimony, that Yellow Pages could and might be dealt with. We believe that the universal service section of Senate Bill 142 also would take care of the imputation issues included in Yellow Pages over a whether it's, and I think it offers perhaps some more protection for some consumers than this approach, but just in the long run, the end game is the same.
So if I understand you right, you're saying that you would rely on the funds in the universal service to maintain the residential rates?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, a question. Senator Miller brought this up, and I too share his interest in the fact that we got this opinion today from David Schuman, District Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General, and he does say, and this relates specifically to U.S. West, about your opinion on it. It says, in light of the A4 agreement that we have talked about many times, in an interim U.S. West and the PUC in 92, it is their opinion HB 2579 is enacted would probably violate the contract clause of the Oregon Constitution. But Deputy Schuman goes on to say, we also know that the state would face risks of financial liability to U.S. West Oregon ratepayers for breach of the A4 agreement if 2579 were enacted, and that utility invokes the provisions of this bill to lower the refunds or to maintain or increase its existing utility prices. Essentially saying the state, the ratepayers, in this case the 1.2 that U.S. West would have, the state would be liable for that as a contract violation. And I know you don't have this in front of you either, so, and I've just read through it as you were talking, but I would appreciate your addressing that concern, not the constitutionality out of Ginny, but the liability of the state to those ratepayers.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I'm not able to do that at this time, never having seen this document. I have no idea.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
I'm still dabbling over that idea. Perhaps we should sell a company. Didn't, a number of years ago, didn't U.S. West sell off some of its exchanges, its rural exchanges?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, yes, we did.
At that point, were you required to credit some of the sales proceeds back to the customer base?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, yes.
So there is a historic precedent that if you sell a company, you have to give some back?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I think there's a precedent that in each kind of transaction which we would file with the Commission, there is the back and forth of what makes this a useful transaction both for the company and for the ratepayers. And in each case, the outcome of that is going to be somewhat different. But in each case, I think it's fair to say that the Commission works very hard to ensure that ratepayers are not harmed and, in fact, benefited in every way that they can be.
further questions.
If I might respond to that also, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, in the event, and it would be highly unlikely, that the company had to sell something like exchanges or other pieces of property or loss, the customers would absorb the loss as well. And again, our issue, our fundamental disagreement with the proponents of the bill is that this is also property.
So you kind of said, I guess the regulatory framework then is you kind of look upon any utility as the ratepayers, in essence, owning part of the assets.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, we do, since they paid for them.
I guess you could say the same thing about if you buy jeans, you own part of the jeans company, too. It's sort of a novel. But I understand that maybe the attitude, you know.
Senator Beyer, I was just going to say, not exactly.
Shelley, do you have a comment?
I was just going to say, we would disagree with the fact that the ratepayers own the Yellow Pages.
I'm sure
you're stockholders. We understand we have a disagreement. I think I'm going to recess the hearing.
Can I just make one remark about the about the DOJ letter, since the question came up? We did receive a grant copy on Friday, brought the information over to Legislative Council for them to take a quick read, and this morning we did have a response. They'll be happy to give a response in writing if the committee wishes. But the response in general about the question of constitutionality because it violates the contract related to the AFOR is Ledge Council has a different opinion from that rendered by the Department of Justice, which is similar to the opinion that you have seen in the debate that you have been exposed to related to Senator 142.
Recess the public hearing, and Representative King, you're the first representative on here. We'll open up the public hearing on 3001. Is that what you're here on? And Representative Beyer, which bill are you? 3622. Okay, welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Al King, District 44. Representative Al King. And I'm going to testify on House Bill 3001. I know you have a busy schedule, so I'll be very quick. This is very simple, straightforward bill. It requires the auto dealers to do continuing education, and which is not something that would be paid for by the state. The association would put together a program, but the course would be approved by the state. And I also need to declare a possible conflict of interest, as Monty King has always been my brother.
Can't choose your family.
He's executive director.
Thank you. Questions for the representative?
I'd certainly be glad to go further. Representative Morgan and I were the co-sponsors. I believe there was no opposition to this either in committee, and I believe that it passed unanimously from the House floor. There are some dealers who don't have very much education. We have a whole bunch of laws that require certain standards and passing titles and protecting the public. And if people can't read or we can't read the standard, we need to bring them up to speed. With that, I'll stop here in the interest of time for the committee.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, well, since we have other representatives here, we'll close or recess the public hearing on House Bill 3001 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3622. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Representative, District 28. Before you is House Bill 3622, which passed the House with 58 yeses and one no, a bill that would add Christmas tree producers, licensed Christmas tree growers to a person who is covered by the agricultural produce lien law. It's a relatively simple bill. We define Christmas tree as being an agricultural produce, which it really is. It's the most perishable commodity there is. If you can't give them away on December 26th. You just pay people to take them. This would only be for growers of Christmas trees, licensed growers of Christmas trees. Christmas tree growers who grow more than 1 acre of Christmas trees in Oregon have to be a licensed grower. and also is only for trees sold for it to be resold, so it does not apply to Christmas trees if used as a homeowner or the end-use consumer come and buy a Christmas tree and don't pay for it or write a bad check. You would not be subject to this law. It's only for Christmas trees purchased for resale. A very simple bill. I don't think you'll find any opposition to the bill, and I urge a due pass, and unless there's any questions, I just urge you to move into the workstation and get this lady out of here if you're going to deal with it again.
Okay, John Foster is your...
He's with me. He doesn't need to talk unless he wants to.
Open up a work session on House Bill 3622. And the chair moves House Bill 3622 to approve DuPont's recommendation. Any comments, objections? So ordered. And anybody want to carry this one? Senator Thank you. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3048, Representative Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix in Salem. House Bill 3048 comes to you. I don't believe anyone else has signed up to testify on it. The reason I filed this bill was I had a constituent who came to me who had put their household goods into storage, thinking that the storage company provides insurance as part of the coverage. And unfortunately, the storage units, several of them burned down and all the household goods were destroyed. And then they found that there's no insurance. In cooperation with the industry, we've developed language in this bill which simply provides that she would explicitly be signing off yea or nay as to whether or not there is coverage for the content, so that any person would then know, get going into the deal, that they have coverage or not. And if they don't have coverage, they could arrange for it on their own to protect the items that they're storing. The bill comes to you with strong support, and again, I don't know of any opposition now that we've modified some of the language to clarify some of the provisions, and I would encourage passage.
Thank you. Any questions? Any other testimony from anybody in the audience? We'll close the public hearing and open up the work session on House Bill 3048. The chair moves House Bill 3048 to forward due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. Carrier? Senator Beyer, okay. Okay, we'll open up public hearing on 3001. Representative King was here. Monty, are you?
Monty and
Chief Shepherd. Welcome, gentlemen.
Are you going to impose anything in it?
No.
Are you going to impose anything? Just say you should.
Welcome, Pete. Introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepherd. I'm here representing the Department of Justice. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, and I'll simply say the Department of Justice supports House Bill 3001 as amended and as it is before you. It's a great idea. The used car dealers are to be commended for coming up with it. It's going to be a step in the right direction in terms of consumer protection for all the other benefits that it also has. And I don't have to declare a conflict of interest. Mr. King is not my brother.
Monty, you want to add anything or just you're serious and supportive?
For the record, my name is Monty King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I've given you a letter that you can read at your leisure. I think it's pretty well been worked pretty hard, not costing government any money. The industry is doing it itself. We do not have any opposition that I know of. I've tried to take care of everybody, and I think we're ready to go. It was 59-0 in the House. I don't know of anybody who's against it.
Questions?
I'm a co-sponsor of this bill, but I do have a question, Marty, that it came up. I noticed that the exemptions for the education program, and one of which is on line 22, where it's a national auction company, blah, 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 that primary activity is the sale or disposition of sold vehicle. Would this requirement also be required upon an auction company that deals in classic cars, for example, that do business here in the state of Oregon, like the Cruise Auctions come in or Silver Auctions from out of state, would they be required to follow this as well? they don't do total vehicles. They come in and sell Model A Fords, you know, at auction. How would they fall under this?
Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger, they would fall under the bill on the continuing education if they're licensed in the state of Oregon. If they're not licensed in the state of Oregon, then they wouldn't fall under it. It is possible under reciprocity, my understanding, for dealers in other states to come into Oregon and conduct business as dealers, but they can't do retail business and they can do wholesale business. The auctions in the state right now, the two major auctions, Brazier's Auto Auction, Cascade in Northwest, Portland and Eugene, and Portland Auto Auction are included under the bill and know they're included and have no problem with it. I talked with Mike Brother, general manager of Portland Auto Auction, last week, and they are very, very supportive of the idea of nationwide, in fact, of dealer education. They know they're included in it. They have no problem with that. So, I mean, if there's one little auction person who's doing something, they're selling cars, they need to know all this stuff, too.
Any questions? This is public hearing. Open up a work session on House Bill 3001. Is that the right one?
Mm-hmm.
And the chair moves House Bill 3001 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, objections? So ordered. Senator Messer, you want to chair that one? All right, thank you. I will return to
the rolling stack, so we can set on the sort of the mobile home thing.
Okay, we'll open up the House public hearing on House Bill 3501. Who are the folks here? Mr. Branham.
That wasn't a good sign.
That was it, I guess.
You had a concern there for a minute, John. Is that your so you announced your name and you go running out the door.
Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
How about maybe David wanted to come up there with me? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman, and today I'm representing the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. A little over a year ago, the board, Mortuary and Cemetery Board, was not sure about whether or not someone from practicing out of state could come in and pick up dead human remains and remove them back to the state where they lived, and sought an attorney general's opinion. And so what happened for a while is it was found that out-of-state funeral service practitioners could not come into the state and pick remains up. And so most of them, both sides then, the borders, began a new process of making arrangements with an out-of-state funeral home to make business connections with, and then it worked profitably, but it did impose some additional charges to the families involved. So what the major thing this bill does is to give some limited privileges for out-of-state funeral service professionals and allow them to come in and pick up a body, take it back to the state where they're from. This has reciprocity language. This applies to states that have similar language that allow our practitioners across the border and come in. It's makes a one-time registration in Oregon with the establishment. Firms don't change hands very often, but personnel do often change hands, and so this makes it very simple and has this one-time registration with establishment. If the establishment sells or changes hands, the new establishment must come in and register again with the state of Oregon. That pretty well is the bill as it started. I did have a problem within the profession. Some firms have wanted to hire some out-of-state professionals and found that the board found they couldn't license them in Oregon because they wouldn't be able to meet, in some instances, a requirement in Oregon that requires a two-year associate degree. And so they were been unable to move to the state unless they were to go back and get a two-year associate degree. We did that made that requirement last session in order to continue a process of upgrading the profession. So what we're asking to do in this bill is to allow the board to overlook that requirement of a two-year associate degree. If a person has been practicing for a minimum of 4 years as a funeral service practitioner or embalmer in another state, they would be allowed then to come into Oregon and take the examination for licensing in Oregon. There's some further cleanup amendments, so I think the last to come up are the dash six, and those take care of some technical problems in the bill and then some conflicts, and then it does go back to changing language back to file from some attempts to substitute submit. David Coe is here as a representative of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and is in the back room. If you have any questions of him, we both have been working on this bill, board and OFDA, and urge that you adopt the dash six and pass the bill.
Dash five.
Dash five.
Dash five and six.
The dash six, too, isn't it?
Both of them, or
is it
dash
six? Just the dash six. The dash six incorporates the dash five and does a situation of fixing the conflict.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, and members of the committee, the dash six was drafted after dash five because there is a conflict. And if you remember the last time the committee dealt with a conflict amendment, it was because of a section of the current statute which had a time limitation. That was, and it's related to ORS 432-307 at this point, that's causing the conflict. Well, in this session, there has been Senate Bill 29, which had passed already, and 29 repeals the time-limited portion of ORS 432-307. So this conflict amendment is to take care of the action precipitated by Senate Bill 29. Of course, the bill that we're looking at now was drafted before the repeal took place. And as you can imagine, we need to iron out the time limitations and make sure everything is finished.
We need the dash six.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Buck.
I'm sorry, I didn't perceive this bill's progress until this point, but a matter of family interest, we have a cemetery plot for my father in Washington County. He's in Spokane, Washington. And I guess under the provisions of this, we'd have to have permission from the state of Washington to move the body to Oregon. And there's some kind of reciprocity here. How does that work, and can it work for a same-day burial?
For?
Same-day burial.
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping perhaps my colleague from the board can come up and answer that.
Yeah.
He's going to know better than I am.
Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
My name is David Coe. I'm the investigator with the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. And if you could repeat the question, that would be helpful.
Burial plot in Oregon. The resident in Washington. And desires same-day burial. Instead of the practice of embalming.
Under current circumstances, if a funeral was taking place in the state of Washington, no doubt a death certificate would already be issued. And under current circumstances, death certificate serves. The Washington death certificate would serve as the burial transit permit. This legislation is to allow Washington funeral providers to care for remains where the decedent has passed away in Oregon, rather than waiting for 2 or 3 days to obtain an Oregon death certificate, which is currently required to transport to Washington. This bill will allow a Washington funeral provider come to Oregon, pick up those remains, and take them back to...
Did that answer?
Yeah. And there would be a reciprocal provision allowing Washington licensees, or Oregon licensees, would be able to do the same thing in Washington. The hang-up currently is the requirement for a death certificate can sometimes result in a delay for a licensee in Oregon to file the death certificate, because Washington licensees currently are not authorized to file Oregon death certificates, nor are Oregon to file Washington death certificates. This bill is an effort to streamline that system so that families aren't inconvenienced and so that licensees aren't inconvenienced by the border.
I don't think that solves my problem, but I understand, I think, what you're doing with the bill. What I'm concerned about is this same-day burial and no embalming involved.
And no embalming, no funeral service. This would be an immediate burial?
Yeah.
Insofar as a death certificate was filed within that one day, burial could take place. But under no circumstances, either in Washington or Oregon, before or after the passage of this bill, would burial be permitted prior to the completion and submission of a death certificate. That's a requirement in both states, and that will remain so.
Thank you.
Okay.
So now in this bill, the death certificate requirement is waived. So who would issue the death certificate? Would that be a Washington person then? Or?
The death certificate requirement would not be waived. It would simply allow the removal of remains
Oregon,
Washington, or vice versa. And at the point of removal, the registrant, the out-of-state funeral provider who's a registrant, submit by mail, no doubt. That out-of-state licensee would, under this provision, now be authorized to file an Oregon death certificate. And that filing of the death certificate would take place prior to final disposition. It's just that the removal from the state could take place.
So the Washington State person could issue the death certificate of death then?
Under this
jurisdiction actually could. Okay.
Would the licensed funeral director issue the death certificate? Is that the way it works?
Under this bill, any person who is authorized under Washington law, for instance, to file a death certificate, someone who registers with the Oregon State Mortuary Cemetery Board would be authorized to file. Registration will apply to establishments and the individuals who are employed by attempt to register individual funeral practitioner.
So, but they don't. You don't have to wait for the death certificate that's issued by the licensee.
Okay, a doctor is assigned the death certificate. The
doctor signs, and then file the death certificate with the state registrar. Actually, it's copies of the death certificate. Those are issued by the health division.
Okay. For the question. Very good. It took me a while, right? Work public hearing, open up a work session on House Bill 3501. Oops, yeah. Okay, yes. Chair moves the dash 6 amendments to House Bill 3501. Objections? So ordered. Chair moves House Bill 3501 as amended to the proposed due pass recommendation. Comment? Objections? So ordered, and I'll carry that. That's my expertise. I've been labeled with that. Carry that forever. Now we're going back to our... Okay, we'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2579. And I guess that panel is done. So Ben and Diane.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Diane Cowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon PUD Association, for the record. I represent Northern Wasco PUD, which is located in the Dalles, and Columbia River PUD in the St. Helens area, down the river to Clatskanie, and then all of Tillamook County is served by Tillamook PUD, and then Central Lincoln PUD serves the Oregon coast and Depot Bay to Reedsport. We're here today in support of an amendment to House Bill 2579. We don't have a position on the bill as it was submitted. Our amendment would expand the authorities of PUDs to include telecommunications infrastructure, telecommunications service, and advanced telecommunications capabilities for economic development. Our amendment is found in the Dash 2 amendment on page 3, lines 14 through 16. Oregon PUDs are a creature of the Oregon Constitution, Section 12, Article 11, which states that PUDs may be created for the purpose of supplying water, for the development of water power and or electric energy, and for the distribution of water, water power, and electric energy. Our governing statutes, as you know, are in ORS Chapter 261. The legislature can't remove one of our constitutional powers, but can expand upon our authorities in 261, which is what we're asking for today. In fact, the legislature expanded our power several years ago to allow us to enter into agreements for the purpose of promoting economic growth and the expansion of or addition of business and industry, which created our authority to participate in economic development activities. While the development of new technology has brought us to another threshold, electric utilities throughout the nation, and PUDs included, are upgrading their existing facilities to improve their own communication capabilities. The PUDs have completed or are in the planning stages of development of very sophisticated high-speed networks within their communities in rural Oregon. We'd like the clear authority to share that infrastructure with the people and businesses that are in our communities. To alleviate fears and concerns of incumbent telecommunications suppliers, we met with their representatives and discussed issues they might have with PUDs entering into the telecommunications world. They expressed concern about our condemnation authority and our ability to issue tax exempt bonds. I'll take just a minute to talk about both of those. Our powers of condemnation, it's an interesting scenario would have to happen for a PUD to exercise our power of condemnation today. We have to be doing that for our electric or water service. And so the fear that they expressed, that maybe a PUD could be formed somewhere in the state, they'd come in and condemn all of our telecommunications infrastructure to do telecommunications, that scenario can't exist because we have to be formed for the purpose of water or electric, so we could only condemn for those two. However, if we do have telecommunications authority in statute, we would be able to use our condemnation authority at that point. I offered telecommunications representatives language that would narrow that condemnation authority, which would, it excluded their lines and facilities that were used solely for telecommunications. With the exception of US West, we said our language was fine, if not received a response from any other company. On tax exempt bonding authority, that's another concern that I heard. There's very strict federal rules in place that govern tax exempt financing. The primary one, and the one that I believe is with this issue to rest, was the rule regarding private use. If the bond proceeds are going to be used for more than 10% private use, then we have to issue taxable bonds for that 10%. Central Lincoln PUD did not use tax-exempt bonding for the portion of their system that they would hope they'll be used for private parties. The PUDs aren't interested in becoming phone companies. What we want is the ability to share our infrastructure with our communities if the big guys aren't going to provide the technology in the near future. And we understand that rural Oregon isn't as attractive financially as the Portland market or the I-5 corridor. We also understand that some rural areas are getting the attention of the large companies, however, and if those companies are considering our communities, we would like the authority to connect to their system. We are already putting that infrastructure in for our own use, and it makes good business sense to connect our systems with their infrastructure and share the sophisticated technology with our community. What we have envisioned is a high-speed technological system in place in various parts of rural Oregon.
which you can see is basically down the river and down the coast. And that'd be a system that could be used to enhance the private companies through partnerships or through our own efforts if the private companies do not construct equally sophisticated infrastructure in our communities. I ask for your support of our amendment to House Bill 2579. And with me today is Dan Doty, and he can speak a little bit to the, he's a member of the Governor's Oregon Telecommunications Forum Council and is a employee of Central Lincoln PUD.
Welcome, Ben. Introduce yourself, please.
For the record, my name is Ben Doty. I'm Telecommunications Manager, Central Lincoln PUD. Chairman Nelson, the rest of the committee. I'm glad to be able to be back and testify today. I'll just kind of rephrase living in the rural Oregon and on the coast of the last part of Diane's testimony. We simply see that there is no investment being made in our rural infrastructure area. In the last 10 years, we've seen Portland. The advent of the deployment of the faster services, the DSL, which rolled out, there's been some legal problems, but we see investment occurring. There's competition in the metropolitan areas. That's not happening in my neighborhood. In our the coastal environment has the highest, among the highest unemployment rate in the state. It's clear that telecommunications is one of the key infrastructures for developing any kind of commerce, electronic commerce among those, but to support that business, our PUD, ours particularly, is in a position to offer it a portion of our network up for economic development. We're charged with that. We take it quite seriously. And we see, over a period of time, some ability to create partnerships with the existing providers. We've got infrastructure that they simply don't have the money to or will not make the investment in. We can share that. We've already got some agreements in place with one of the larger providers that's bringing that infrastructure to bear for those people. We'd like to be able to do it directly with our own authority rather than through another agency's authority. With that, I think we can make something happen. Set a model. Our utility will be the model for this to happen with the rest of the PUDs. We can make it happen and create a clearer path. 3 or 4 years of pulling this pony around, I like to ride it for a while. Thank you.
Questions? So, do we have a copy of that amendment? Okay. Did that? Those are the
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the dash two amendment is exactly, if I understand, the same as what we had included in Senate Bill 142. Mr. Chairman, Jerry, with the exception, we added the language back in to promote economic development. And we used a defined term of advanced telecommunications capability. I'm not sure that's the one that was in 142 because it was, this went for one that had a defined definition in federal statutes.
Okay, very good. Any questions, comments? Thank you very much. First panel, would you like to comment or on any of the proposed amendments, or Shelley, or any of Joan?
Mr. Chair, I know I just returned, but have you guys addressed this aspect of it yet? So, Chris Green on the dash two.
It's on the relating call.
On the relating call? No, we did not talk before we passed an audit.
Okay.
Wow, that's bizarre. My gosh. A little bit popping up today.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. Gary Bauer of the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I was not part of your first panel, but Shelley asked if I would join her. The concern that I think the telecommunications, existing telecommunications providers and some of the new competitive providers have with the PUD's proposal is specifically the area in under condemnation. And in the general powers and follow the amendment real fast here. On lines 16 through 18 of the proposed amendments, it's very clear that the PUD has the right to exercise the power of eminent domain for carrying out the provisions of that of this chapter. And if you add telecommunications to the chapter, it means that you carry out eminent domain powers for that. As Ms. Callan stated, we have had a number of conversations with her and her association. The concern is a couple of fold. One, and she has addressed the issue about somebody forming a PUD solely to provide telecommunications services. But the other is, if you're already in business and you aren't providing electricity and you then extend yourself into telecommunications, absent, you could then use the power to condemn a telecommunications facility or system. And that is a very bothersome to anybody that's already in that business. She did propose some language, which I have been shopping around to various telecommunications providers. Two providers actually have said they're comfortable with it. Two others are still trying to get their attorneys to kind of look at it. The concern is that the language she proposed talks about limiting the condemnation to condemn existing lines and facilities used solely for telecommunications. I think as Mr. Doty has explained in some of his testimony, one of the purposes for adding broadband networks is to actually use it for energy management systems. And a concern we have is if a telecommunications company is providing energy management for, let's say, another company, does that then make it, then it's no longer, quote, solely for telecommunications? So I think what people are looking at is whether there's a way to craft some constraints around the condemnation authority that would not allow it to be just a pure telecommunications, or if you're providing anything else, then we have a right to go after that. Those are our concerns, Mr. Chair.
I would just echo what Mr. Bauer said. He's been sort of the point person on this for the telecommunications industry, that we are concerned about making this a level playing field, and we had been working with the PUDs, and we had also had some not really companion legislation, but it kind of turned out that way on the House side, that would have put some limits around any public entity going into the telecom business. And so we were concerned about the fair competition aspect of it, the eminent domain, the taxing authority, that kind of thing.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. John, did you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Joan Smith for the PUC, we have testified as this topic has come up from time to time, and we would like the committee to know that we wholeheartedly support the PUDs. The more competitors, the better. Perhaps this language is troublesome to some of the incumbents. I hope they work it out. However, personally, I think it's a red herring, because if a PUD got into the business of local exchange service, they would come under the jurisdiction of the commission to be certified. Their certificates could be conditioned, and if that was not enough, then Section 253 of the Telecommunications Act of 96, which prohibits anti-competitive behavior, would certainly apply.
Okay. Any questions? We'll close public hearing on that on Senator House Bill 2579. We'll not go into a work session at this time. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2924. Charles Stern. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee for Land Records. The object of this bill is to clarify the recording of fixture filings in the county clerk's office. What brought this bill forward is I was looking over some minutes of a meeting that was held back in 96 with Frank Bronner and Alan Bricky and a number of people, and I said, you know, we never did anything about it. We talked about it, never did anything about it, so we had this bill drafted for introduction in this session. Most UCC filings occur with the Secretary of State, but fixture filings, these are which attach to real estate, are continued to be filed with county clerks. And this just clarifies how we index them, how they're going to be recorded as mortgages, and be happy to answer any questions relating to it.
Any questions?
Close public hearing on House Bill 2924. Open the first session on House Bill 2924. No amendments. Chair would move House Bill 2924 to the floor to be passed recommendation. Comments? Objections? Bill is carried. We'd like to volunteer to carry. Senator Miller? Open the work session on House Bill 2577. And that is the...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill, a question for House Bill 2577 was heard by the committee many months ago. If you remember, this bill would direct the Public Utility Commission to report annually to the governor and the legislative body for the EBOR on status of competition and regulation of the communications industry. The gist of the testimonies you heard were, one, the proposal of the bill identified the content that were included in the bill to be included in that report, and the rationale for having the PUC come in front of this body and talk about the state of competitiveness. And much of the reason relates to, since competition is a very important part of the regulatory goal, that if it's spelled out clearly as a direction to the PUC and that the legislative body hears it periodically, then that becomes top of mind for the regulators, and therefore you will be in a position to be informed of what policy directions are being carried out, and if there are shortcomings in statute or other areas that need to be remedied, you will be in a position of taking more proactive steps toward encouraging competition. The discussion involved in the public hearings were, one, should there be a combination of this report, which is directed by House Bill 2577, and other reports that the PUC is required to do, for example, the sale of competitive zones. And after the hearing, your administrator had conversations with a number of people, and while some people think that it's better to have one report consolidating everything, others feel that it's more appropriate to have smaller, more frequent reports, each report focusing on a particular subject. And in fact, the state of the competitive zone report really is a statistical reporting, while the report requires here by House Bill 2577 really is more of a policy framework document. So they are at very different levels in terms of content and their purpose. The other concern, which is perhaps a very minuscule one, is when there are fewer, bigger reports to promote reason, or even be familiar with the content of the report. And for the very practical or pragmatic reasons is that some argues for having more frequent specific reports. So we do not have any amendments to this bill, and if the committee feels the direction included in the bill is sufficient, then the bill may be ready for being resolved.
So this question, we have one big report or several little ones, is that?
The PUC does currently have direction to provide annually a report on the state of competitive growth. And this bill would direct the PUC to provide a report on the state of competition. And if you look at the bill language, it's directed toward looking at what policies are put in place, or how well they're carried out in order to encourage competition. The other suggestion at the last public hearing was to include those reporting requirements embedded in Senate Bill 142. In the state report as well. And those reporting requirements in 142 relate to infrastructure development, investment, capital funds that are allocated for general infrastructure improvements outside of the 142 funding. And so basically you're looking at three different reports. You have the competitive zone report, you have the policy report related to the state of competition and how policy wants to adjust or how well the policy intents are being carried out. And then you also have the 142 reporting related to infrastructure investment.
Yeah, it's a do-nothing bill. What we're saying is it's a do-nothing bill. I mean, it does require a huge report coming in, but it may not be of any value at all.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your staff did not suggest this is a do-nothing bill. In fact, the requirements included in House Bill 2577 are different from what currently is required of the PUC in reporting. And after review of the content intended for that report, the staff's opinion is it would be a very useful piece of information to inform the legislative body of future adjustments in policy.
Okay, did they talk about how much more this work that this is going to cost for the PUC or whether they have to adjust it for that?
There's no additional there's no additional cost.
All right. Does anybody have any hearings on this, one way or the other?
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I'd say that I think it's a good idea. It talks about the issues that we've talked about, trying to get direction where the PUC is going, what's accomplished. It has a sunset date of 2005, and so it's during this time frame that we're trying to do something. I don't see anything in the bill that says it can't be under the same binder as any of the other reports. So it certainly could be combined in the same. And I think it addresses some of, puts a little more focus on some of the issues we've talked about in terms of what that is going on. And CTE supporters would love to support them on a bill.
All right, we're in a work session and we have no amendments. The chair would move House Bill 2577 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? Order. Senator Metzger, would you make that
check?
I don't like to say this is a do-nothing bill.
Okay, we'll change roles here.
Okay. Open up a work session or public hearing on House Bill 2608. And we have Jack and Jack Barnes and Doug Pedersen and John Powell. Yeah. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for all this pretty enlightening stuff we're doing. All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Barnes, representing Farmers Insurance, and with me today, Doug Hetherington, who's the manager from our TIP office in Portland. This bill, we're here in support of House Bill 2608, which came across from the House with a 59-0 vote. The bill deals with personal injury protection or PIP benefits, and that's the coverage on automobile policy that pays for the medical bills or wage loss. The PIP statute provides that every motor vehicle policy in the state will provide PIP coverage to insured members, passengers, and household members. Until recently, we had not seen this as being a problem. However, Farmers Insurance writes a separate policy for each vehicle in the household, and this has not been a problem until a recent interpretation of the statute, and it appears as a result of that that each policy would have to apply for a single accident. So if we write three policies, an insured is involved in an accident with one vehicle, if the injuries in that go beyond the PIP limits, then the other policies would have to apply. We refer to that as PIP stacking. that's created an inconsistency in the marketplace. Some companies write one policy and list all of their vehicles under that policy. So in that case, the PIP limits on the car that's involved are the only limits that apply. What this bill does is just try to return back to what we had understood the PIP statute to be in the past and remove that inconsistency in the marketplace. I understand also that there is an amendment that's been submitted to increase the mandatory PIP limit from $10,000 to $20,000. We would be in opposition to that amendment, and our concern is that liability coverage is also already an affordability issue to some people. By doubling that limit, our concern is that there would be a greater number of people that would have the difficulty affording insurance and may go without, leading to the uninsured motorist problem. Higher PIP limits are available. At Farmers Insurance, we already offer limits of $25,000 and $100,000 for parties that desire those higher limits. So we have expressed your support of the original bill, the opposition to the amendment. Be happy to respond to the question.
Thank you. Keep track of this. My name is Doug Hetherington. I'm with Farmers Insurance also. And I'm just here to help Jack answer any questions.
Any questions in the panel? Very
much.
How long is the $10,000 limit in effect?
I'm not sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I'm not sure. I had heard that it was 1974, but I'm not sure.
Okay. So, quarter of a century or so? Well, would it be fair to, I'm looking at the amendment here, the $20,000, would it be fair to assume that the buying power of $10,000 25 years ago would be at least, if not in excess of $20,000 today for the same coverage in 1974?
Senator, that may be true. The problem is that there are higher limits available to those parties that desire them, but by making this mandatory, it's really putting people in a position that may not be able to afford that coverage in a position where they have to, and it's mandated by the state.
Okay. And then another question, sure. Mr. Chair. So as I understand what you said about stacking, so if I have, say, four individual policies with Farmers Insurance, and they all have a $10,000 tip on it, and I'm involved in an accident, and the claim might be $25,000. They would take 10 off my car A, and then take 10 off car B, and then up to maybe 5 off car C, and Farmers would be then on the hook for $25,000.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's correct. The problem is, however, is that the premium has only been collected for $10,000 on the vehicle, and so basically there would be, if you have four vehicles, there's $40,000. Coverage for any accident on any of those vehicles that you the premium has not been paid for that, as opposed to the company that writes one policy and lists all the cars under that, and that one is only the coverage on that specific vehicle. So if you were with one of those companies, you'd have a $10,000 limit.
Okay. So the question would be, though, whether that as an individual, you're also paying for that protection on each of those policies separately. And so the question is, are you writing that for your protection only embodied in that particular vehicle, or in aggregate? I mean, if you're the policy writer, the policy holder and writing the check, might be a little different perspective on that. How do you feel? You know, you're doing, you're paying again each of those vehicles, even though you can only drive one at one time. You would be still paying for that injury protection for all four of those as well.
Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger. The effect of that, however, is that actually you're paying for $10,000 per vehicle,
right,
but you really have $40,000 coverage per vehicle. So it would be a benefit to you, I suppose, but you're really not paying for the coverage that you're receiving. And that's the inconsistency in the marketplace. Without this bill, there will continue to be that inconsistency where some carriers, you know, will not have PIP stacking and others will.
Are you any comments? Thank you. Any further questions? Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. Before you today, representing TGU, North Pacific Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman, members, we are one of those companies that lists all the cars on one policy. And in fact, because we do that, the way the law has currently been interpreted, we, our company has an advantage over a company like Farmers. So we would be one of those companies who, because of the way we do business, has an advantage. But we support this bill because we think the intent of the law was to have a policy limit attached to the face value of the figure that the consumer purchased. As was just discussed the other day, I always try to make my kids baseball games, which is difficult when you put the weather together with this process. So I'm usually heading out of this building as fast as I can a couple days a week. When I arrived at the game, I found out that three of our vehicles were at the game. My son just got home from college was driving one, my wife was driving one, and I was driving one. Now, had we all been involved in an accident, our PIP limit would have applied in each case, as opposed to stacking those values. And so the face value of the policy that you purchase is the amount of coverage you have for that an occurrence with that vehicle. The inflation issue could be on, and so we agree with the bill as it came to you, and again with a unanimous vote from the House. The issue of whether to double the PIP limits is an issue that could apply to all automobile coverages. You could apply, you could say, well, the liability limit should be doubled. We should double the property damage value. We should double PIP. We should double all of the policies. But the issue of affordability that was just raised, although PIP is a relatively inexpensive coverage, and the reason is rates are determined based on losses. And PIP is affordable for the most part for the average driver, the driver that does not have an age of 18, 19, or 20, a driver who has not had a series of tickets and accidents. But for those people, PIP is no longer really inexpensive. And it can run to be a substantial portion of a premium in even a six-month period. So for a lot of people out there who have to buy, quote, high-risk insurance, PIP is still mandatory, and it is expensive. So we would hope that the committee would pass the bill without the amendment. Again, we have about 250,000. If you look at the current auto market, there's a million or so policies, maybe a million three out there. And any kind of a mandatory increase in that PIP benefit is going to quickly turn into millions of dollars, not just the few dollars that each individual has to pay. A lot of times the reason that people would suggest that you increase PIP benefits is motorcycle accidents. But motorcycle policies do not carry a PIP benefit. Most of those that are sold have a very small medical payment portion to the policy of $1,000 or $2,000. So this bill would not affect those kinds of cases. So if you look at the number of cases that a hospital may end up with costing more than the minimum limits, even though there are others that charge, or even though there are many people hospitalized and get out without busting these kinds of limits, if you raise everybody's coverage to catch that few, again, as Mr. Barnes said, additional coverages are available. In my case, I have health insurance. Your PIP pays first. And if that's exhausted, your health insurance takes over. I have disability insurance. So my desire, and the only reason I carry some increased PIP benefits, is to protect passengers, because it also applies to passengers. Otherwise, I would not carry any additional PIP benefits. So, quite frankly, I don't want too much of an increase in the PIP benefit, because I buy insurance to protect me, and about almost 90% of Oregonians have health insurance, and that would take over in a terrible accident after your PIP benefits are stopped.
John, I think we get to a point of prudence, John. Probably the people most at risk are those who have a hard time buying it at all.
And if they get into an accident, serious accident, you get over that $10,000 bill very quickly if you're in the hospital in a couple of days. Well, not that the hospital necessarily costs that, but if you're in one a couple of days, you were hurt pretty seriously, and but it's going to be there long. Who ends up paying the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, it would be a mixture. I think in many cases, it's the health insurer that would pick up after the PIP is exhausted. And anyone covered by health insurance, Guardian Health Plan, Medicare, any of those coverages would be picked up after your PIP is exhausted. But the PIP is primary in an auto accident. So most people have that kind of coverage. There are obviously some people who are uninsured. And again, that brings back the imbalance of trying to meet the needs of some people in the medical community and the needs of that equation to the needs of the average citizen.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Ted Patterson and Dr. Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Ed Patterson, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. As introduced by the chair, or announced by the chair, Dr. Bill Long is here also to testify at my request. Let me give you a little history of what's gone on, and then we'll address the issue of the amendment. Dr. Long has been involved in the evolution and the development of the state Oregon's health trauma system since 1985, when the original trauma system bill was adopted, and has been given the title of the father of Oregon's health system, or trauma system. Oregon's one of the first states in the nation to develop a sophisticated trauma system, as we do have, and part of that trauma system creates a category of hospital emergency rooms. You may or may not know that we have different levels of emergency care. And the highest level of emergency care is a level 1 rated trauma center, which is Emanuel Hospital and Oregon Health Sciences University emergency room. Dr. Long is the chief trauma surgeon for Emanuel Hospital's emergency room and a trauma surgeon, if I didn't say that already. Essentially, if you need a light flight helicopter, regardless of where you are in the state, whether it be Pendleton or Welch's or Lake Oswego or Hillsborough Springfield, if that light flight helicopter comes to your hospital to pick you up, then every other time, one out of two times, you'll be going to Emanuel Hospital. So that's a major role that these two level one hospitals play in the state. And Dr. Long can address some of the benefits of our that have evolved in terms of development of our trauma system. You'll hear from Dr. Long in just a moment, but first let me tell you a little bit about the bill. Dr. Long called me about a year and a half ago, and we've worked together on not only trauma system, but subsequent legislation relating to trauma care. We wanted to get together and do something about the state trauma system. There were significant developments in the evolution of the trauma system in the metropolitan area, but there were significant shortcomings in the downstate area. So he brought together representatives from Emanuel Hospital, including himself, and persons from the Oregon Health Division, Emergency Medical Services Section, persons from the Health Sciences University, and a few others to sit down and kind of brainstorm what we wanted to try and do in the 1999 legislative session. We did eventually develop a bill, and that bill was subsequently called Senate Bill 911, appropriately enough, and is passed out of the Senate Human Resources Committee and currently is in the Ways and Means Committee, waiting for funding, and I'm encouraged by the co-chairs that funding is probably going to happen. But as part of the drafting of that legislation, I was called by legislative counsel one day into the session indicating that the portion regarding the increase of the PIP insurance and the other half of that bill basically includes improvements of infrastructure in terms of the trauma system, make some grant money available for downstate emergency medical services, needs for radio communications, for ambulance services, some medical services. The legislative council, to make a long story short, informed me that the bill would deal with two subject areas and therefore would be unconstitutional. You would have to pull out the increase in the PIP insurance, which is the same as we're talking about in our amendment. And so I said, well, fine, then let's introduce a separate bill. And the legislative council indicated that I was beyond the introduction date for a bill, and so therefore the Senate Bill 911 went forward to the Senate committee without the inclusion of the increase in the PIP insurance. I passed out to you just the impact on Emanuel Hospital, and I just want to refer to that list that we circulated. You can see in the very top line of this where it says all MDAs, these are strictly motor vehicle accidents now, all MDAs, Emanuel Hospital in the calendar 1997 had 919 motor vehicle accident patients. Of the total charges generated by those 919 patients was $19.8 million. The total collected piece of that from MDA insurance was $13.2 million, or a collection rate of 67% of the charges that were incurred by motor vehicle accident patients. Emanuel Hospital alone had to write off in 1997, $6.8 million. But I think the key component of this is the average charge in 1997 versus what was referred to, alluded to by Senator Metzger, what the charges were back when the $10,000 cap was put in. The average charge now in 1997 is $21,500. I don't have the data for 10, 15, 25 years ago, but I can assure you in the healthcare arena, those charges were dramatically lower than that 25 years ago than they are now. So we think you can make a legitimate argument that at least PIP should try to maintain something close to what the average charge is, recognizing that the charges, or half of the charges at least, are substantially greater than that from serious motor vehicle accidents. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2608 was the vehicle I had been looking for virtually all session. It was over in the House committee, and I got the sponsor of the bill, Representative Bowman, to introduce our amendment for that. The committee on the House side took the amendment from the Farmers Insurance Company and basically did a gut and stuff and introduced the Farmers Insurance Bill as a replacement bill for 2608. And although the chair or the sponsor over there mentioned this in testimony, the committee chose not to take any action on it. So I did follow it to the Senate side and requested that an amendment be drafted to basically perform the other half of what we think are very important enhancements to the emergency medical services of the state of Oregon. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I can turn this over to Dr. Long, who, as I said, has been with and part of the evolution of the trauma system in Oregon, has a national reputation for knowledge of trauma systems, and let him speak to you based on his knowledge and the need for this particular amendment.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Dr. Bill Long, and I'm trauma director at Emanuel Hospital. I'm also chairman of the State Trauma Advisory Board for working with the Oregon Health Division to try to improve trauma care in the state. Let me give a little bit of background information. Injury-related research has demonstrated that the civilian application of principles learned from military management trauma can significantly reduce injury-related morbidity and mortality. Concentrating trauma care in specialized facilities in a metropolitan area where multiple coordinated services are immediately available is essential to achieving optimal outcomes for these patients. In rural areas, however, there has not been much attention addressed to this issue. And so where a hospital is unique in the communities, like, for example, St. Charles and Bend or Eugene or Corvallis, for example, reorganizing the care, emergency care within that hospital into a fast track for trauma patients also gives optimal outcomes for these patients. Without an organized, consistent approach to the trauma patient, the resources necessary to assess and treat the injury victim will be absent or slow to respond, making diagnosis and treatment haphazard. Oregon is recognized throughout the nation as the leader in trauma systems development. We were the first, second state to develop any sort of statewide trauma system, and we were the first to include rural hospitals as level fours, which the American College of Surgeons recognized this year in 1999 as a model, and now includes that as part of its national guidelines. The state of Washington also added level fours to their criteria as well. And that allows small hospitals where even only general practitioners might be the only providers in that community hospital to be able to participate in our program. To give you some of our successes, Four recent studies show that rural Oregons have a better chance of surviving a serious accident because of the Oregon's trauma system. We did a study comparing the ATAD 7, which is St. Charles Hospital in the six counties in eastern Oregon, and compared it with Montana, Michigan, and North Carolina, and showed that we had a 5% preventable death rate there, while Montana showed 17%, Michigan 12.9%, and Carolina, North Carolina 28.5%. All four states have similar population density, geographic restrictions, and healthcare resources. So it shows that we have made a significant improvement than what was there before. Most recently, the tragic incident at the Thurston High School also brought to bear what can happen when the community works together. We had a major debriefing after that accident, after that tragedy occurred at Salem Hospital, and we had a review of 911, the pre-hospital care response, and all the medical response. And we found that because of a coordinated approach, in part because of the trauma system, there were no unnecessary deaths, and the optimal resources of the community were well utilized. And the surgeons, both at Sacred Heart Hospital, which is Dave DeHaas, is the trauma director there, and Amy McIver at Mackenzie Willamette Hospital, accredited the trauma system for making a significant impact in their organization and making these necessary changes. The economics of trauma care are quite interesting. 50% roughly, plus or minus 5%, are related to the automobile. The rest of it are distributed among violent trauma, which is usually no pay, industrial accidents, recreational accidents, and home accidents, most of which do pay. Of the vehicular accidents, and I'm excluding people being run over, pedestrians being run over, and people being hit on bicycles by cars, just taking straight motor vehicle accidents, 20% roughly, plus again minus 5% depending upon year, have no insurance whatsoever despite a state law to the contrary. Another 20% have only the PIP as their insurance. That's their only insurance. They have no supplemental insurance. And so what's happening over the years, since I testified here in 1985 and 1987, the mean hospital charges have risen from $11,000 up to $21,000, $22,000. So there has been an inflationary factor on the cost of care. And you look at some of the data that Ed has brought to you, when you look at people who are on the Oregon Health Plan, you'll find that their average charges are $32,000 compared to the average for all motor vehicle accidents, $21,000. These people need much more resources in terms of social services and psychiatric services, et cetera, to get them back into functional society after you've fixed up their wounds and bandaged their cuts. This has major effect then on how hospitals economics take place and whether or not the surgeons are going to get paid. I just got back from Medford this morning where three surgeons have said they will not take call for trauma patients anymore because they get less than 40 cents on the dollar for taking trauma care in their particular community. That means they have to give up a day either in their office, they have to give up a day in the operating room where they could potentially earn $4,000 to $6,000 a day to get nothing for potentially taking trauma call. And they're talking about saying, we're out of the system. We're not going to do it. You recently had an article right here in this city where the surgeons don't want to take trauma call. They don't like it. And so money doesn't solve all the issues, but if you can reduce the number of patients who are not paying anything for their care, or relatively little for their care, I think it would go a long way to showing good faith as to what's happening for this unfunded mandate. And so I'm concerned that if this situation in Salem and Medford gets out of hand, somewhere the hospitals are going to have to sit there and either raise their price structures or whatever to be able to provide emergency medical care, which is not what the intention of the trauma system was to begin with. So I hope that you will consider this issue of the PIP, because if for 20% of the population who are involved in motor vehicle accidents, this is the only form of insurance that we can get our hands on.
Questions? Yes, Senator Barr.
Ed, I guess I'd ask you the same question I asked John Paul. The write-offs. When you list these on the sheet, here's a, I guess it's Dr. Long's sheet, it's $6.8 million in write-offs. Now, write-off is a quite way thing of shifting the cost to somebody else in a hospital setting. Is that right?
Senator Beyer, hospitals, for the most part, have no other sources of income but what they generate for the care and treatment of patients. And when hospitals put their budgets together, they have to calculate what kind of write-offs, if you will, they will have, what kind of bad debts they will have, what kind of charity care they will have, And that cost is actually an expense for the hospital, so you build that into the cost structure. So the reality is the higher the number of write-offs, the higher the number of charity care, the higher the rates in the hospitals are going to be, which is exactly why our association has been so strongly supportive of the Oregon Health Plan, and in fact it has reduced the number of write-offs.
So that's reflected in terms of when we say on here and complain about the health plan cost going up, part of it is the write-offs?
And the write-offs, correct.
Any questions? Sometimes that's also why my back at the office, my health insurance costs are going up.
You've had a time over the last 4 or 5 years where health insurance hasn't gone up. Very dramatically at all, very small, one single digit inflation rate, and that's been very great savings, and now, of course, we're seeing another phenomenon.
Those were a nice couple of years, but unfortunately, they didn't stand around very long.
Dr. Don, do you want to respond to any of that, or you think you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other little announcement. I just received a health division press release that says tomorrow is emergency medical service provider recognition day at the Capitol. So how fitting it would be if the dash four amendments were accepted by the committee for the bill.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, John Powell representing TPU, North Pacific Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman, I think the only thing I would add to the discussion at this point is that the data given, as was pointed out by the witnesses, is from Emmanuel, which is a trauma center. So what you're looking at in terms of claims are probably the most concentrated or exaggerated size of claims, because only the worst of those claims, like flight, those sorts of things, are in this mix, and that there are many, many insurers who policy provisions do pay the extent of, you know, the broken bones and the things that occur in automobile accidents. So again, the average cost here probably the highest you could find.
Okay. Thank you, Jack. Do you want to say anything?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jack Barnes, Farmers Insurance. Our only concern, I guess, is to restate what I said earlier, that, you know, as the rates go up, we would be concerned about there being more people that are uninsured. That's already a problem that's exhibited at the trauma centers, and if the rates go higher, it could be, you know, continuing increasing that problem.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We've lost some of our members, so we'll close the public hearing, and we'll figure this out at some point, and we'll get feedback from the other committee members and see where they're standing. And we'll move on from there. We have no further business. Any adjournments?